Hello, everyone. I'm Paul Menzel.
And I'm Jim Conlon. And this is New Tricks for Old Dogs.
Our podcast features the many ways us older men and women howl at the moon.
Odd news items you don't normally hear about, and conversations with other old dogs who are growing bolder, not older.
So if you've got 25 minutes or so, grab a cup of coffee, pull up a chair, and join us.
In this episode, the old dogs wonder who we'd root for if they went on strike. We give our take on Elon Musk's giant rocket fail. We offer creative uses for coffee grounds. We report on an overenthusiastic sperm donor. We remember Harry Belafonte. And we praise a lady who found a bag full of money and didn't keep it. The Old Dog's conversation is with Larry Barsh, a Boston dentist who discovered there's more to life than pulling teeth. Stay with us. Paul, I gotta know.
What?
What is on your mind today?
Well, here's something to think about. In the news, all over the place, is the Writers Guild strike.
All over, yeah.
All over. They say we need to have a better living. Well, hey, everybody needs to have a better living.
Well, no,
I mean, I wish them luck. I am a union guy, I must say. But you know what? It's kind of hard to rally support for Writers Guild because these people are, you don't know their faces and you don't know their names. You know what
That's
I mean?
That's unfortunate. You know, that is unfortunate because we should know their names. If you read the credits, you know, which go by so fast you can't. But if you did, you would notice that there is a writer for every TV show, every
well,
movie.
Who sticks around for the credits? I'm usually making a sandwich or.
Right. Well, what would you care about? Let's say somebody else went on strike. Who would you care about if they went on strike?
Well, I would care about me.
Ah.
You know, what if seniors banded together and went on strike? You know, name your cause. Better Medicare. Higher Social Security. You know, wrinkles. Doggone, those wrinkles.
I protest against
we
wrinkles.
Must stop wrinkling.
Yeah. I'd strike for the four-meal day, personally.
of course, then you have to deal with how do you go on strike?
Okay. How would you go on strike? What would you do to go on strike?
Well, one thing you could do is you could jam your cart into an aisle.
Ooh.
Maybe two or three carts and refuse to let people down the aisle in a grocery store.
That's how
that would be a protest, wouldn't it?
Sure.
You know, you pick an aisle that maybe where the Depends are.
Elon Musk had to work hard to make lemonade out of the lemon of his Starship rocket when it exploded 4 minutes into flight in early April. This pod nugget is from the Washington Post.
The test flight of the SpaceX giant rocket named Starship had some problems. At liftoff, it sent a shower of rocks and debris several hundred feet in the air. It also shattered the concrete launch pad and ignited a 3.5-acre fire near the pad.
Three first-stage engines failed to ignite, and a few others went out on the flight, causing it to tumble end over end. The automated flight termination system, which is designed to destroy the rocket if it goes off course, took too long to activate.
Now, this is the rocket that's supposed to ferry astronauts to and from the moon. It was not SpaceX's finest moment, but the CEO, Elon Musk, was determined to spin the mess as a success. His comment was, "It was roughly what I expected."
Now, at first blush, this seems like a lame response to what happened. A multi-billion-dollar contract with NASA is at stake. You'd expect some form of a mea culpa, but Elon Musk never fails to amuse. If this is what he expected, what were his worst fears?
Well, maybe we can learn something from what we can call Musk speak. When you screw up, find a way to spin it as a success. Let's say you fall down and break your arm. It's not an unfortunate accident. You were testing your bone density, and it was roughly what you expected.
Or how about a car accident that was your fault? You were just testing the airbag deployment, And it was roughly what you expected. Well, you get the idea. Thanks to Elon Musk, bad outcomes look good because it was roughly what you expected.
Like most adults, we keep our eyes open with coffee. Well, maybe it's time to also open our eyes about the many uses of coffee grounds. This pod nugget is from the website Nothing Political.
Once a pot of coffee is brewed, the used grounds usually end up in the garbage. In the interest of making our caffeine habit more sustainable, here are some creative ways to use those used grounds.
Coffee grounds contain caffeine, which has been shown to increase blood flow. Mix them with coconut oil to create a simple and natural exfoliant for your skin. Gently massage the scrub into your skin and rinse with water.
Coffee grounds make a great fertilizer for plants. They contain nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium to aid plant growth while keeping snails and slugs away.
Coffee grounds are an effective deodorizer. The aroma of the grounds can help eliminate odors in your fridge, closet, or any other space that could use a fresh scent.
Coffee grounds are a great cleaning agent because of their abrasive nature. Add water to make a simple paste that can scrub away stubborn grime and stains.
And finally, the lowly but versatile coffee grounds can be used as a meat tenderizer. The acidic compounds found in coffee can help break down the tough fiber in meat. Mix the grounds with your favorite spices and rub the mixture onto the meat before cooking.
Perhaps you're intrigued by the many uses of coffee grounds, but you don't drink coffee. Ah, no problem. Simply make a pot of coffee, and once the coffee is done, set the grounds aside and pour the coffee down the drain. Then proceed to use the grounds in one of the many ways we have suggested.
Paul, by the way, did you know that the number one consumer of coffee in the world is the kitchen drain?
Oh, I thought it was me.
You're a close second.
Sperm donations, despite all the jokes, are a legitimate medical procedure. That is, if you don't get carried away with all your donating. This pod nugget is from Sky News for April 29th, 2023.
A Dutchman identified as Jonathan M. has fathered at least 550 children through donating sperm. National guidelines in the Netherlands limits donations to a maximum of 25 children with 12 mothers.
Jonathan M. exceeded those guidelines by lying to prospective parents about the extent of his efforts. His lawyer said his client wanted to help people who would otherwise be unable to conceive.
The mother of one of his children sought an injunction forcing the donor to stop his widespread offerings to fertility clinics. The presiding judge agreed, and Jonathan M. was forced to end his long-distance parenting.
Now, this isn't the first time that someone was exposed for over-donating their sperm. The puzzle is why someone would turn a charitable act into a hobby. Well, perhaps they just wanted to be in the Guinness Book of Records for the largest family reunion.
Well, whatever the motivation, it seems reasonable that sperm donors should be honest about their efforts. Family trees are complicated enough without dealing with unknown half-siblings. Or is that saplings? In late April, Harry Belafonte died at the age of 96. The man was a multi-talented actor and singer who was remembered for his social activism. This pod nugget is from Time Magazine for May 8th, May 15th, 2023.
Folks our age recall the handsome and charismatic entertainer who burst onto the scene in the early 50s in a series of unforgettable movie roles. He was one of the few crossover black stars at the time when the nation was still segregated.
His 1956 album of Caribbean songs made history as the first album to sell a million copies in the U.S. Despite his success, he encountered discrimination and hate. In Hollywood, he was offered safe roles for a black actor, like the kindly handyman, and he received death threats from the Ku Klux Klan.
At the height of his fame, Belafonte left entertainment to devote himself to the civil rights movement. He was a behind-the-scenes organizer for sit-ins, freedom rides, and marches. He was also a trusted confidant of Martin Luther King and in the front lines of the March on Washington.
His interests in social justice were global. He fought against apartheid in South Africa and genocide in Rwanda. He became a UNICEF global ambassador and spearheaded the 1985 We Are the World event that raised over $63 million.
He remained a dedicated activist into his 90s. He raised awareness on voting and mass incarceration. He served as an honorary co-chair of the Women's March in 2017. He told Time magazine ahead of that march, "Had I not been led to a place of activism, nothing in my life would have been worth its existence."
Harry Belafonte was a man who could have had an easier and more lucrative life as an entertainer. Instead, he chose to devote his life to social activism and helping open the eyes of the world to injustice. That-a-way, Harry, to howl at the moon.
You know how the old dogs like to celebrate good deeds. Well, we got a great one to share with you today. This pod nugget is from the Washington Post for February 7th, 2023.
Diane Gordon's Jeep Liberty broke down about a year ago. She couldn't fix her car, and a new one was out of the question. Since then, she's walked 2.7 miles 5 days a week to get to work. At the age of 65, that's quite a workout.
One day in January, she was walking home from work when she decided to stop at a convenience store for a snack. As she opened the door, she looked down and spotted a Ziploc bag full of money. $14,780, to be exact.
Well, while she could have used the cash, she turned it in so it could go back to the rightful owner. Her simple statement was, "If it doesn't belong to you, you don't keep it."
Well, that's not the rest of the story. Someone impressed with her honesty set up a GoFundMe site. In less than 1 week, more than $60,000 were donated by strangers to Diane Gordon.
With the donated money, she was able to buy a new Jeep Compass and complete some home repairs. Diane was overwhelmed by the generosity of strangers. She said, "I never expected anything like this. I was just doing what I was taught to do." Well, Diane, you deserve a happy ending to your story. Larry Barsh was a respected dentist, but that respect didn't hold him back from engaging in other pursuits. He also became an award-winning photographer, a medical talk show host, and most recently, a podcaster like us. Even now, Larry continues to ask himself, what else is out there? Well, Larry, let's get started. We're fascinated by all of the different things that you have done, but it seems that your main focus for a long time was being a dentist. Tell us how you got into dentistry and why that led you to so many other activities that you've engaged in.
I see absolutely no relationship between getting into dentistry and everything else I've tried to do. I don't know. I think it was my brother's orthodontist that talked me into it.
Well, it's a good sturdy occupation.
Yeah, 40 years worth was just about enough. And when I retired, I decided to try other things because I got bored after about 5 minutes.
Well, what did your brother's orthodontist say to you that got you interested? What was his pitch?
Sort of like the opener of Little Shop of Horrors. You know, be a dentist. It's good for you, son.
Yeah.
And it was, it's an interesting career.
Well, you're also of a generation, Larry, where you were expected to have a respectable career. It had nothing to do with whether you were attracted to it or not.
We all were. I think I wanted to be a marine biologist, but trying to make a living and support a family on $8,000 a year just didn't cut it.
So when did you develop your interest in photography, Larry?
Way back, even before we got married. I've been married for coming up on 62 years, and I was interested in photography before that. When we got married, I put a darkroom in the basement. And my usual line was, "Nobody flush the toilet. I've got temperature problems down here," because the water would get cold or warm. in the house at that time. And living in Boston, the Boston Globe had a annual photography contest. And it was 1976, and things were going on in Lexington and Concord at the time. So I said to my wife, I think I'm going to go over and take the prize-winning photograph. And she said, yeah, sure, have a good time, honey. I entered a picture. About 2 months later, I got a notice, you have been chosen as one of the finalists in the contest. And I looked at her and I said, look, see, I told you. And she said, yeah, one of the finalists. How many hundreds of people are one of the finalists? About a month after that, I got another notice that said, you have been chosen to be in the next group of selected photographs. And I said to her, see, told you. And she see I selected photographs, 25, 30 people. Well, this went on, and I finally got a notice, you have won grand prize. And that really set me off in photography.
Looking at your biography, you were a staff photographer, a studio photographer for a couple of TV shows. How did that come about?
Well, the way that happened, when I retired, my wife wanted to live in New York City. So we moved to New York City. Let me answer that straightly. Nepotism. My son was directing a couple of daytime television shows at the time, and he said, our photographer can't make it. Would you fill in for him and get some pictures of the Jane Pauley show? And I said, oh, that sounds like so much fun. And it was.
So you started as a replacement and you just stayed on?
No, I stayed on as a replacement for one or two photo shoots. And then whoever the photographer was came back. He got well, and I was out the door.
So then you turned your attention to artwork, I understand. There seems to be this visual component to your interest once you retired.
It developed as part of the photography. I was looking to do more with my pictures and took a couple of courses on digital photography and digital art and creating new images from ones I already had. It's sort of fun to create new things from what goes on in your own imagination to pictures that you find or purchase and combine that with photographs of your own.
Okay, but in addition to that, you had experience with talk radio dispensing medical advice, right?
The local radio station in Boston, WBZ Radio, had a call-in physician, and he wanted to take some time off. And they asked me if I would do his radio show. And after the first one or two where the nerves were really on edge, it became fun. So I filled in on some Sunday mornings to a total listening audience of three and some drive time at noon. One interesting call I got, at the time I was very much interested in dentistry's role in snoring and sleep apnea, mouthpieces that control snoring, which can lead to sleep apnea. And I got a call from a gentleman who said, I am desperate. I need help. Do you make house calls? I said, well, not really to do this because I have to be in my office, but why do you need it at home? He said, well, it's not exactly home. My cellmate is ready to kill me because I keep him up all night snoring. Then I developed, with the help of a programmer, a very large directory site for people who had snoring and sleep apnea problems. The physicians got a little mad at me because of the title of the website. I called it Snoring Isn't Sexy. the physician said, that's not professional. I said, maybe not, but it gets people to talk to me about the problem, starting from a very light, friendly sort of atmosphere. And then we could go on and explain where that leads and the problems with sleep apnea. When we moved to New York City, as I said, I got bored. So I took some courses on developing websites commercially and did that for 3 or 4 years. And that led to the larger website.
Larry, what were the circumstances that led to developing your podcast?
During the pandemic, I thought people our age, including myself, would like to hear people talking. And a podcast seemed a way to meet interesting people that otherwise myself and listeners couldn't meet.
Yeah, so how do you find your guests?
Mostly people that I just would like to talk to myself. I've looked through TED Talks, which is an interesting way to find people mm-hmm. who are really interesting to talk to. And about, one out of every 10 will respond.
So it sounds like you have to spend some time digging up guests.
Most of the time is spent looking for guests, and then a substantial time spent looking for their background so that I ask some intelligent or sort of intelligent questions. I think we all deserve a pat on the back for willing to put ourselves out there, because most of the podcasts aimed at people our age are done by 30 and 40-year-olds
right.
who just cannot have the perspective that we do. But there's more to our lives than sitting down and discussing what pills we take mm-hmm. or what's our most recent surgery or a friend who is having a medical problem. There's so much more to our lives at this stage.
Well, you know, we are sort of in the same age group, and we grew up on radio, which makes us a natural audience for podcasts. But for some reason, a lot of folks our age are afraid of the technology.
It's a serious problem, because I think what we offer is more than just the subjects and the talk. I think we offer companionship to people our age who are isolated. I am trying to get my courage up to go live, because I'd love to have audience participation. I'd love to give people who do listen the chance to talk back.
You know, you are obviously very very informed and a very curious person that keeps informed. What's your secret?
I think curiosity. I think change. Trying something new, I think, is essential. I see so many seniors, people our age, who just fall into a rut and continue to do the same thing over and over and over, and don't have the courage to try something new. I think there's more to life than what we experience in our own lives, no matter how many different things we try. There's a world out there that, this is beginning to sound like a Miss America question, but there's a world out there to be curious about. And I think it's up to us, especially at this stage of our lives, to experience as much of it as possible.
How much longer do you think you're going to be podcasting, Larry?
I don't buy green bananas at this stage of my life. I don't know. As long as it continues to be fun, and then who knows what might be beyond that.
Like what you've been hearing? How about sharing the joy with your friends? We can always use more listeners. There are more episodes on the way, so stay tuned and keep howling at the moon.